we should give our country.
Well, let's say the indigenous box has been ticked and we've solved the problem.
That we cannot give indigenous Australians up without giving up much of our identity.
To actually recognise the difference.
You're doing it because you're acting like a Jew. Respect rather on race.
You how long set up a same
race. We need to as a mature country be able to.
The future where the Parliament resolves that the injustice is in
You know what? It's time to listen.
Welcome to Time to Listen, a podcast for the voices of First Nations peoples and those working in the Indigenous sector. I'm your host, Josephine Seal. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we record this podcast, the Gimoi, Wallabara, Yidinji and Irukandji people. I'd like to acknowledge their elders past, present and emerging. I'd also like to extend that acknowledgement to the country on which you listen to this podcast. Welfare has long been publicised as a path towards greater equality, economic empowerment and social well-being. But does long-term income support actually do more harm than good? Join lawyer, academic and Cape York Partnership founder Noel Pearson for the second and final part of this year's Renata Kamina Oration. Noel's speech focuses on the creation and perpetuation of the passive welfare underclass and the urgent need for a universal job guarantee. In part two of his speech, Noel highlights the importance of not only improving the capabilities of the long-term unemployed, but he also emphasises the need for the structural opportunity of employment. Thank you for taking the time to listen.
Economist William Mitchell's design of a federal job guarantee, proposing an employment buffer through a minimum wage, makes this story even more sickening. This is what I realised 2 years ago, reading Mitchell's work. It was not necessary to use an unemployment buffer to manage wage inflation. Inflation could be managed through an employment buffer using the minimum wage. For the past 30 years, I've watched the devastation of my people from Cape York Peninsula from intergenerational welfare dependency. The awarding of weekly wages for Aboriginal stock workers did not result in the economic equity many had hoped for. Many lost their jobs, migrated to townships, and are today churned through unsuccessful employment programs with no real pathways to the mainstream economy. The 1970s saw many Indigenous people, along with other Australians, moved on to welfare where they stayed for life. This social catastrophe was complemented by the introduction of pubs and poker machines, which allow welfare checks to be recycled back to government and their corporate friends in these vice industries. Verily, as the black American economist Thomas Sowell once said, the poor are a gold mine. But my people were not the only victims of the shift away from full employment. Since the mid-1970s, the number of long-term unemployed in Australia has continued to rise, despite 30 years of uninterrupted growth for the rest of us. There are now pockets of suburbs and towns that have experienced between 50 to 70% unemployment over successive generations. All of our communities in Cape York Peninsula fall into this category. Since the mid-1970s, we, the Australian elite, abandoned full employment with little regard for the impact on the most marginalised, the disabled, the poorly educated, Indigenous people, newly arrived non-English speaking migrants and sole parents. Australia was never meant to be a country of haves and have-nots. Those who reconstructed the nation after World War II were at pains to ensure no one was left out, putting aside the original peoples. They truly believed everyone had something to contribute, putting aside the original peoples. And they designed policies to ensure this occurred, putting aside the original peoples. The dividend was a nation that experienced unprecedented productivity and full employment, putting aside the original peoples. Please pardon my repeated qualifications here. I have the difficult task of trying to remind mainstream Australians of the golden years of post-war full employment and prosperity for white and migrant Australians, whilst not forgetting that the Indigenous peoples were still excluded from this growth and opportunity. It is the same dilemma Americans have when they remember the great advances made as a result of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, whilst having to admit the exclusion of Black Americans from its benefits was also the truth. But allow me to nevertheless evoke the memory of the prosperity of the post-war period for your people, especially the disadvantaged among them. Regrettably, more than seven decades after World War II, Australia is a country of haves and have-nots. This is not because we had to be, but because of policy choices that were made. The people of Cape York were the first movers on welfare reform in Australia. We knew it was our right to take responsibility for our future. We got on the front foot and designed a reform model that focused on building the capability of those on welfare so they could take a fair place in our own land. In our own country, Australia, the people whose dispossession, in the famous words of Justices Dean and Gordon in Mabo's case, underwrote the development of the nation. We designed the Family Responsibilities Commission. Run by local leaders, the commission builds the capability of those on welfare who have not exercised responsibilities in caring for their children, sending them to school, upholding their housing arrangements, and refraining from violence. The Commission conferences our people and supports them to take up the personal responsibilities which passive welfare has eroded. 14 years on, and this model is yielding profoundly important results. Over the past 6 years in the five communities in which it operates, child protection notices have reduced by 69%. Tenancy breaches have dropped and serious offences have fallen by 20%. Money management has improved and parents have saved hundreds of thousands of dollars collectively in student trust accounts to cover the costs of their children and grandchildren's education. The Cape York welfare reform model is working on the personal and family responsibility side of the equation. Personal responsibility is crucial to progress. The other side of the welfare reform equation is opportunity. And in particular, the opportunity of jobs. But jobs have not been realised as part of the welfare reform deal. The results we've achieved with personal and family responsibilities would be amplified if people were provided with real jobs. Over the past 14 years, job numbers in our communities have remained stagnant. Close to 70% of our people are unemployed. Most live in social housing. In our original report to the Commonwealth Government in 2007, we argued that quid pro quo for responsibility and obligations should be opportunities for jobs, education and home ownership. The gap in Indigenous affairs will only be closed when responsibility and opportunity are combined equally. Attempts to achieve this are non-existent in Australia. President Bill Clinton tried with the enactment of the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act in 1996. Let me repeat the name of this legislation because it captures correctly the necessary policy combination, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. The legislation aimed to reconcile the behavioural dimension of welfare dependency and the structural opportunity of employment. It is clear this reconciliation was dependent on the availability of work. The deal showed signs of working during the Clinton years of growth, when jobs became available but could not be sustained in the downturn. You can mandate personal responsibility, but if you leave work opportunity to the market, then the reconciliation collapses. When there is a downturn, true reconciliation required the mandating of personal responsibility and work opportunity. If Clinton had done this, he would have fulfilled Dr. King's vision in the Freedom Budget, whose bedrock was a government jobs program. He didn't do it. He mandated only one side of the equation. He was under the grip of the neoliberal turn in social democratic economic policy thinking that resisted full employment as socialist nostalgia in favour of market solutions. Moreover, the pittance of the American minimum wage and the unconscionable way in which workers in the lower strata of the labour force have to stitch together multiple jobs to earn a living made the Pororo reforms a tragic farce. If we're going to close the gap, not only between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, but between the unemployed and the rest of Australia, we must ensure there are enough jobs for all those able to work and who want work. 2 years ago, I had to confront this great truth, a truth that had never been fully apparent to me. The truth was that full employment was possible without letting the inflation genie out of the bottle. I'd swallowed the economic orthodoxy that 5% unemployment was the price the nation had to pay for economic stability, continued private sector investment, and high living standards. That was until I read University of Newcastle economics professor William Mitchell's proposal for a universal job guarantee. His concept is simple. It is a job for all those needing and able to work. The job pays the minimum wage, superannuation contributions, and leave entitlements. It brings the dignity of work to every Australian, including the disabled, mentally ill, and extremely disadvantaged. And it is a completely superior alternative to passive welfare. The first benefit of the job guarantee is that it lifts the income of the poorest Australians to a decent level. Only those who have never lived on the dole can say that people can live on the dole. The second benefit of the job guarantee is that it gives people all of the intangible, personal, psychological, and social benefits that come with work. Only those accustomed to the opportunity of work can afford the luxury of the idea that work is not foundational to the well-being of all humans. Mitchell's insight on the government job guarantee came to him as a student studying agricultural economics at this university in the late 1970s. Learning the logic of the one-time wool stabilization scheme to stabilize the income of producers through the seasonal heights and troughs of the clip and to minimize inflationary prices, the scheme provided for the government to buy the surplus and store it in those ubiquitous red brick wool sheds near the country's wharves. The retained surplus was released in the years when the clip was poor. The anguished memory of his working class father's descent into unemployment had become the young student's life-defining purpose. And he asked himself, if the government could buy up idle wool from producers and release it to the market when demand picked up, why could not the same be done with idle labour? This was Mitchell's eureka moment. And he dedicated his life to the pursuit of full employment and the concept of a government-funded job guarantee. The crucial breakthrough Mitchell made with his job guarantee is that its design would mean that full employment with the government as employer of last resort would be non-inflationary. He argues that there are two ways to manage inflation in employment policy. The first, to use unemployment as a buffer, stock against pressures, and the second is to use employment as the buffer stock. Providing the job guarantee is anchored at the minimum wage, a universally available full employment scheme will not be inflationary. From Mitchell, we have the means to achieve full employment without increasing inflation. This is the third benefit of the guarantee. It works as an automatic stabilizer in the economy. The pool of workers in the scheme rises and falls with the economic cycle. In a downturn, the pool grows, and when the labor market picks up, the pool shrinks close to zero. Mitchell has provided a policy solution to the social catastrophe playing out amongst Australia's most disadvantaged. In Indigenous policy in particular, Mitchell has given us the most powerful policy tool to close the gap, not just on employment, but most other gaps dependent upon employment, something which has addled the bureaucrats and technocrats. Since discovering Mitchell's proposal, I've advocated to all governments for a universal job guarantee. I've been told in response that the jobs would be unproductive. Aboriginal people would just be painting rocks. The scheme would undercut private investment. It would antagonize the unions. It would drain the budget. The unemployed aren't capable of working. But these are not the real reasons for the lack of interest. The real reason is that acceptance of Mitchell's argument would require us, the new elites of the neoliberal turn, to admit we have it wrong. It would require we, the new elites of the neoliberal turn, to admit that we aided and abetted a social catastrophe of enormous scale amongst the voiceless Australians. It would require we, the elites of the neoliberal turn, to consider the family breakdown, addiction, violence, misery and suffering that our policies have caused to the voiceless Australians. It would require we, the elites of the neoliberal turn, to admit that the unemployed are not innately lazy or defective. It would require we, the elites of the neoliberal turn, to admit the government has the fiscal capacity to fund real jobs instead of passive welfare, but has chosen not to use it. And most excruciatingly, it would require we, the elites of the neoliberal turn, to change the system that has gifted us and our own families significant wealth and power at a time when the unemployed and their families are broken and left bereft. The reasons we struggle to gain traction on a job guarantee are threefold. Firstly, so many of us, myself included, submitted to the economic orthodoxy that lower levels of unemployment will be inflationary. Secondly, this orthodoxy suited business, who prefer that at the lowest reaches of the economy, the scarcity of work should maintain a race to the bottom on wages. And finally, the political class know that our social security system does an outstanding job at pacifying the excluded and the disadvantaged by cutting off their hope and aspiration and giving them the false promise that their secondary services and programs will ameliorate their personal and social problems. And if not, then the tertiary services in the form of end-stage medical care, out-of-home care for children, and detention and incarceration facilities can always be expanded. And it is the passive, not the capable, that neither threaten nor make demands on the political system for a better deal. The unemployed become conditioned to think they are inferior and undeserving of anything better, and they give up. I accuse successive Australian governments of deliberately confining over 800,000 Australians to the unemployment line as a permanent destination, where they unnecessarily suffer from poverty, powerlessness, and prejudice. I accuse the Reserve Bank of Australia of not meeting its legislative mandate of full employment by uncritically upholding ideas about a natural rate of unemployment. They destroyed countless lives, the consequences of which they and their own never have to bear. I accuse the Treasury of peddling the fiction that unemployment is natural, inevitable, and necessary to control inflation and resist fiscal intervention in favour of jobs for those Australians in desperate need of them, in the name of budgetary rectitude and debt management, but are quick to change their view when a pandemic threatens the jobs of middle Australia. I accuse politicians for using the unemployed for political gain by directing people's economic insecurities and fears towards the most disadvantaged and away from government itself. I accuse the industry of job agencies of undertaking a fictitious tick-the-box exercise that does nothing to help the unemployed, but instead delivers profits to those who least need them. I accuse the liberals and conservatives of purveying the term dole bludger and creating the illusion that unemployment is an individual moral problem rather than a structural problem perpetuated by neglectful governance. And I accuse social democrats and the left for not doing enough to challenge the economic orthodoxy that has so deadened the nation's economic reform aspirations, and in doing so, abandoning the country's most vulnerable citizens who look to them to champion their cause. Lastly, I accuse myself of not having the policy insight and courage to have said this before. I implore the political parties of all persuasions to gather up the moral and political courage to face these truths, to transform our conventional thinking, and to move past the old false orthodoxies. I implore the Parliament and the new executive government in the next term to wield its monetary and fiscal power to guarantee full employment for all Australians. Thank you.
Wow. Well, Noel, you certainly didn't disappoint. That was quite extraordinary. So I know we started a bit late. We might run about 10 minutes late beyond the 5:30 that I think we indicated to allow some time for questions. So we'll have about 15 minutes of questions. I think Kim's going to pass through some questions if she gets questions from the online. I think we've got quite a large group of people who have been following this online. But we'll start with people in the room. And Noel, I'll get you to come back up. Who would like to kick us off? Maybe just say your name when you.
As an ex-teacher, I mightn't need it, but I'll. You've used just a quick, very brief comment. You've used the term haves and have-nots. I think we now have the have-nots, the haves, and the have-yots. My question is, it relates to your frequent use of the term Australians and citizens, and you made some passing reference to, for example, newly arrived migrants. But there are people refused, people like found to be refugees, but as Eve Lester says in her book on migration law and policy, there is planned destitution of people who are not citizens and can't even get residency unless they wait a long, long time and pay a lot of money. Yeah. So my question is, do you have a response to that?
Are you hear what you're saying? How can I disagree with that?
Thanks, Noel, for a fantastic speech. Matt Tinkler's my name. I'm the CEO at Save the Children here. Last week I was in Palmerston Indigenous Village with my team, and they lamented the decline of the Commonwealth Jobs Program and the impact they'd seen in that community and the lack of productivity and community care. So they would certainly agree with you. My question is, to make a shift at this scale, the question of what jobs would people do becomes relevant, the productive jobs that give people meaning and purpose and contribute to society. Based on your experience in Cape York or elsewhere, what are your views on the kind of jobs that should be targeted and created for this kind of program?
Oh, there's absolutely no shortage of things that need to be done urgently that would have really important implications for the people, their social services, the education of children, looking after the environment, looking after the elderly, looking after the disabled. There's no shortage of work that people need to be mobilised to undertake and receive fair payment for. Put our imaginations to work and the jobs will be in front of our noses. And that's what we've done in the Cape. We can achieve much better outcomes in education and health and services to our people if we had a job guarantee program that provided if people desired a full-time job for 5 days, they could choose to have that, or a part-time job if they chose a part-time job. Everybody needing work should be able to have access to it. One of the things we will have to do, though, since you come from the social services sector, at some point we're going to have to... I see the secondary, primary problem is the loss of work. That's a solution. Secondary services are just a response to that failure. And at some point we're going to have to get rid of the secondary services because they are a diversion of the necessary resources. We need to do it now because there's urgency and misery. But when we strengthen families and they have access to jobs, I see secondary programs, the rise of the service delivery middle class as part of the problem here. It's given us the sense that the problem with these people is that they need the services from the middle class. They need the middle class to have the jobs to save these people. So we keep building out the investment in the secondary support, and we fail to invest in the primary failing, good education, a good job, rebuild the families. What does a family need? Money, income, need to look after the money, need support in doing so, need to support their children in their education, and the school must give them an education. Not the shit that remote kids currently get from their schools. They need the health services available so the mum and dad can take them down there and receive attention. Parents must engage in that. And they need a home that's safe and prideful and happy. You get those things together, that's log cabin to White House stuff. But instead, we're now at this stage where we're creating industries out of the misery. Secondary service industries, and of course, end result is the investment in the tertiary stage grows as well. Prisons, diabetes and other health complications and so on. So, we've got to stop thinking that secondary services are a solution here. They've got to be a stopgap. We've got to be very careful about those secondary services turning into industries, because they have. Out-of-home care has become an industry. There's industries all over the joint when it comes to disadvantaged people. And they're industries that give jobs not to the disadvantaged, they give it to the middle class.
Terry. Hey, Terry. How's it going, mate?
I get a microphone. So you can hear me. Things are going pretty well in some senses, but I wanted to support your comments, and Gareth, the obvious point, well, how do you deliver what needs to be done? And I thought I'd make a couple of comments on that to amuse Gareth, because you already know it. Noel and I first met in the late 90s, I think, when I went to Cape York.
98, 99.
Yeah. And I was at that stage doing a review of Indigenous education in Queensland. And the school at Arakoon was just a shambles. The parents were neglectful, the very things that you spoke about before. And it was the community under your leadership and other communities in Cape York that turned it around with some assistance from the state government, particularly in terms of setting up the family responsibility commissions. So it is possible to do it, but the key point is it has to happen at the local community level, because the Commonwealth government is no longer of any use, perhaps apart from the source of money, in doing something like this. When Rudd announced the Changing the Gap initiative, we set about doing that through bringing back a guy who'd worked for the United Nations and had been posted to one of the most troubled countries in the north of Africa. And the idea was he would have the authority to go into communities, work with communities, and say what needed to be done, and the government departments would be compelled to put money and effort into making it happen. This was to be legislated, and it was the senior levels of the Commonwealth bureaucracy that made sure that that didn't happen, and that the whole strategy for dealing with that problem didn't really have the resources or effort required to make it deliver. Now, my final point is that in Victoria and New South Wales now, through work at the Centre for Policy Development, the CEO for which is here, we've actually found a constructive approach at the community level to finding jobs for the most disadvantaged. And the first big trial we ran was, and you may not know, but it's a big LGA to the west of Melbourne called Wyndham. It had an inspired CEO, and she made it all happen in partnership with us. And so it can be done, but the Commonwealth government can put money in, although in this case it was philanthropic money. But apart from that, they are beyond redemption in terms of ability to design new programs and administer them and reach out into the community. The health department, the education department, 85% of their staff are all in Canberra. They seldom get out and see what's going on around them. The APS in the social policy field is a total failure. So if you're thinking that you can ginger up Canberra to do something, I'm afraid that it won't work.
I completely agree. I mean, the delivery point has got to be local government. But even there, the capacity will have to be rebuilt. So certainly our thinking is that local government has got to be the delivery mechanism for a jobs program in the communities. And the Commonwealth's role is as a funder.
Noel, there's quite a few questions coming online. Quite a few of them involve people who were part of the CDA. Wondering whether what you're talking about is bringing back some form of that. How would you differentiate what you're recommending, what was offered in the past by the CDP?
Yeah, it's not the work for the dole. A job guarantee is not work for the dole, either in its design or, importantly, amount of work you're offered and its pay. It's a 5-day job offer, full-time work for those who want it, and it would be paid at the minimum wage, which is almost double work for the dole. Not working for Newstart. It's a real job, a complete job, pays people at the minimum wage and becomes the platform. So it almost doubles the income that will go into families. These families need that income. They need more income desperately. But it will be a spur for the young people in particular, but all of those, it will be a spur for them to then look for better paying opportunities. So when there are opportunities for mainstream jobs, jobs outside of the job guarantee scheme, they will be in the position both in terms of their mindset, in terms of their skills, and in terms of their training to take up those opportunities. So it is the necessary transitional work program to enable people to get into the mainstream work when it becomes available.
Thank you for being an inspirational Australian leader. I'm horrified that even in my postgraduate study, I was taught about accepting exactly the point that you made today, and it's really been super interesting. My question is there anywhere in the world, you mentioned the Clinton administration, is there anywhere, maybe Scandinavia, that's trialled something like not accepting a standard unemployment rate?
There have been partial trials in some countries of the job guarantee idea. The importance of a universal scheme is to enable the stabiliser effect of the scheme. Having it as a universal solution for all unemployed people is an important part of the design of it. I suspect that that will be the question going forward, whether governments try to trial a region or a cohort that might be offered the opportunities of a job guarantee. But there are important policy questions around the need for universality. And my view is that we should now be pushing for a universal program, black and white, and so that nobody, all Australians, understand that this is an Australian solution for all Australians standing in need of work. Not just for Aboriginal people, it's not just for Cape York people. All Australians are now got the offer of a job under a job guarantee scheme. And I think, as I'm a very strong advocate that a universal basic income doesn't address an important part of the problem of passive welfare. Got to be in complete denial about effect of welfare on people if you think that a universal basic income is any kind of credible response to it. So I think the sheer increase in the investment in these communities and regions will itself generate real jobs in the economy. People will have more disposable income, and they will be investing it in the creation of new job opportunities in those particularly depressed regions of the country where youth unemployment is so high and so on.
Thank you for taking the time to listen. To keep up to date with future episodes of the podcast, follow the Cape York Partnership page on Facebook or hit the subscribe button on your app of choice. This episode has been brought to you by the Cape York Partnership.